Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Steve Norman reporting. United States brushing aside a series of claims by Russian President Vladimir Putin that he has an array of new strategic nuclear weapons that can hit a target anywhere in the world. VOA's national security correspondent Jeff Seldon.
Officials at the Pentagon and in the U.S. national security community are taking a look at the specific weapons that he mentioned. But one of the things officials have said and have known about for quite some time is that Russia, under Putin, has put an emphasis on modernizing and updating its military capabilities, both its conventional military capabilities and its nuclear military capabilities. So the fact that Russia is working on upgraded defenses, missile capabilities, really isn't a shock to anybody in the U.S.
In its annual State of the Nation address, Mr. Putin boasted about his military's newfound capabilities, including what he called invincible nuclear weapons that cannot be intercepted. President Trump has announced that he will impose hefty tariffs on imported steel and aluminum to protect U.S. producers risking retaliation from major trade partners like China, Europe, and neighboring Canada. President's announcement sent shocks through the Wall Street, Dow Jones Industrial Average dropping 1.7%, automakers led by the downturn of Ford and GM prices, S&P 500 fell 1.4%. Nine South Sudanese opposition groups have formed an alliance to accelerate efforts to end the conflict in South Sudan. Since violence erupted in South Sudan in 2013, groups opposed to President Salva Kiir sprang up and its leaders fled to neighboring countries. This is VOA News. The Trump administration calling for Russia's idea for a humanitarian corridor to evacuate civilians from besieged Damascus suburb, a joke. U.S. State Department spokesperson Heather Nord said the 30-day ceasefire in eastern Ghouta, approved by the Security Council, is clearly not working. She said the U.S. blames Russia for continuing to train and equip the Syrian military. Meantime, a senior U.N. official says that he has received indications Syrian authorities may grant permission for a U.N. humanitarian convoy to enter eastern Ghouta to deliver much-needed aid. Lisa Schlein reporting now from the U.N. in Geneva.
He says an international task force on Syria was informed Tuesday the United Nations may receive a permit to enter the besieged town of Douma in eastern Ghouta in the next 2 days.
We have 43 trucks standing by to go there and full warehouses to load into the trucks as soon as we get the permit.
Egelin says he will ask Russia, the United States, and other countries of influence to push for several UN aid deliveries into eastern Ghouta every week. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley has visited Guatemala's Naval Special Forces Base in Puerto San Jose during a trip to the country. Haley's visit comes after President Trump last month criticized countries he did not name for pouring drugs into the United States and called for aid to be stopped. Guatemalan Minister of Government Enrique Degenhart spoke with reporters during Haley's visit and answered questions about what the U.S. could do for Guatemala.
Well, we need vehicles. We need helicopters. We need airplanes. We need land vehicles so that we can move faster. We need communication equipment that could support us in terms of moving faster to the point of interdiction. All those have been discussed, and I want to reinforce this. We have a great relationship with the U.S. agencies that have been supporting us.
As a high-profile U.S. official, Haley's first visit to Central America, also shedding light on U.S. foreign policy for a second year of Mr. Trump's administration. Venezuela, ruling socialist, and some opposition parties have agreed to delay the presidential election by a month till the second half of May. Agreement between the government and President Nicolas Maduro and several smaller opposition parties will give candidates more time to campaign. Get more news at voanews.com. I'm Steve Norman in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bati, Washington. Today is Friday, March 2nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa makes his first foreign visit today to Angola.
Mr. Ramaphosa will visit Angola in his capacity of chair of the Southern Africa Development Community, SADC. The main topics in this meeting, of course, will be the Lesotho crisis.
That's veteran Angolan journalist Mario Alpaivai in Luanda. Zimbabwe's opposition MDC chooses its candidate for this year's presidential election, but there is disagreement within the party. A lawsuit has been filed challenging the legitimacy of Zimbabwe President Emmerson Mnangagwa. And Amazon troop contributing countries call for more funding for the mission.
That is why it is essential.
We'll examine the human rights issues in next week's Sierra Leone presidential election. And a visit next week by Benin's president may pose the first test for France's promise to return African art treasures, those stories, plus Samson O'Malley's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa is today, Friday, making his first foreign visit since becoming President. Ramaphosa, who is the current chair of the Southern African Development Community, SADC, will first stop in Angola and then on to Botswana on Saturday. He will meet with Angolan President João Lourenço, who is chair of the SADC organ on politics, defense, and security cooperation. Veteran Angolan journalist Mario Paivai says, high on the two leaders' agenda is the situation in the Kingdom of Lesotho, where SADC has deployed troops since last December to ease security concerns brought on by the killing last September of the country's top army chief.
Mr. Ramaphosa will visit Angola in his capacity of chair of the Southern Africa Development Community, SADC, and will meet his counterpart, President João Lourenço, which serves the politics, defense, and security body. The main topics in this meeting, of course, will be the Lesotho crisis after this country has been triggered by the last November murder of the army chief, which forces the SADC to send the military troops there. Another topic will be the drought, which now is affecting several Southern African countries. And of course, in this very first but short visit, Mr. Ramaphosa also will have the opportunity to discuss with President João Lourenço the increase of bilateral relations between South Africa and Angola, which are the most important countries in the region.
And Mario, the state-owned oil company, Sonangol, has been in the news lately now. I'm reading that it is also to build more refineries. What can you tell us about Sonangol in the news in Angola?
In fact, so last Wednesday, the recently appointed chairman of Sonangol Group, Mr. Carlo Saturnino, gave his very first press conference after 100 days in charge of this powerful Angolan company. But I will underline one of the things that are making noises not only here in Angola but international, is that Mr. Saturnino, the Sonangol chairman, has accused the former administrations to put out of the country $38 million US dollars, even after the former board chief of Sonangol, Mrs. Isabel dos Santos, has been fired, which is supposed to be illegal. This kind of criticism against the daughter of the former president are making some noises here in Angola. But until now, nothing legal succeeds. Mr. Saturnino also underlines that the net profit of Sonangol was $224 million in 2017, just $81 million in the previous years when the oil prices were lower.
Mario, before I let you go, the Angolan National Assembly is to be considering pretty soon a law on abortion, and it will make abortion a crime, except in the case when the life of the pregnant woman is in danger. What can you tell us?
Yes, it's true. We must take into account that the Catholic Church in Angola is quite powerful and make a lot of pressures on the government and the ruling party, MPLA, to maintain the criminalization of the vote. I must also remember that despite that, there was in the past a strong demonstrations from women against this kind of situation. And we expect in the next Human World Day, 8th of March, so there will be another demonstration when these questions will be arisen by the Angolan woman.
Mario, it's always nice to talk with you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mario Alpaivai is a veteran Angolan journalist. He was speaking with me from the capital, Luanda. Zimbabwe's main opposition, Movement for Democratic Change, MDC, on Thursday chose Nelson Chamisa as its candidate in this year's presidential election. The 40-year-old Chamisa rose through the MDC leadership ladder as the party's youth wing leader. This year's election will be the MDC's first major test since the death last month of its leader, Morgan Tsvangirai, and the removal of Zimbabwe's founding president, Robert Mugabe. But the uphill battle to defeat the ruling ZANU-PF party is being compounded by disagreement within the MDC ranks over the selection of Mr. Chamisa. Dan Moyo is chairperson of the MDC USA branch. He said Chamisa's appointment as party standard bearer was done without consultation.
I must say that it is disappointing that this appointment comes at a time when there is serious disunity in the party, where most party members and structures of the party were not consulted, and part of the decision to elect Mr. Chamisa were senior, where there is no unity amongst the senior members of the party, starting from the National Standing Committee of the party down to the branches on the ground. I personally find it very disturbing that a man of Mr. Chamisa's stature, who is a man of law as well as a man of the cloth, since he's a pastor, would find it in himself to proceed and get himself appointed as the candidate for the party in a process that is so flawed and not inclusive of all stakeholders of the party. I think it has brought disarray to the party, and we're going into an election as a divided house.
So, Mr. Moyo, the MDC has been in opposition for a long time. One would say if the division you are talking about is the disagreement over the selection of Mr. Chamisa is true, then the MDC might as well give the upcoming election to Mr. Emmerson Mnangagwa of ZANU-PF.
I am afraid that is how it is looking at this moment. Unless normalcy can come back to the party and people can sit down in a sober fashion and follow the party constitution, then I don't think any of these problems would suffice. There's absolutely nothing wrong and out of place with calling for a democratic process to elect a president of the party who's going to be the candidate in the elections. Our constitution provides for that, and unfortunately that has not been followed in this instance.
It seems to me if this is not resolved, then would you tell me that the MDC would be ready for election or it wouldn't be ready?
It definitely would not be ready at the state that it is in right now. Remember that the elected Vice President, Thokozani Kuphe, represents a very large constituency of the MDC stronghold, which is the region of Matabeleland. And if that region of Matabeleland feels that procedures were not followed and Thokozani Kuphe was pushed out in an unconstitutional manner, I do not see how they are all going to come out and vote for Chamisa. So we have created a problem for ourselves.
Dan Moyo is chairperson of the USA branch of Zimbabwe's main opposition Movement for Democratic Change. He was speaking with me from Washington, D.C. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, the second day of March. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. Three Zimbabweans filed a lawsuit late Thursday in the country's constitutional court challenging the legitimacy of President Emmerson Mnangagwa. As Sebastian Mofu reports from Harare, the litigants say they want a transitional authority appointed by parliament to run the country until next election.
In an interview, Linda Masarira, one of the three litigants, said they did not want Zimbabwe's former president, Robert Mugabe, ousted last November, reinstated.
What we want the court to do is to allude to the fact that the coup was a coup and that the military actually violated the constitution of this country. We have actually put in a provisional order for the illegitimate government to be dissolved and parliament to set up a national transitional authority that will run the country from the day of the order until the day of elections. Because clearly we cannot have the military commanding our elections. There will be no free and fair elections in that respect.
President Emmerson Mnangagwa was sworn in last November. That was after the resignation of Mugabe following pressure from the military, thus ending his 37-year rule of Zimbabwe. President Mnangagwa has since promised free, fair and credible elections this year, which the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission says will be held between July and August. Over the weekend, Mugabe told a private gathering celebrating his 94-year birthday that President Mnangagwa was illegally in office as the army forced him to resign. Interestingly, Mugabe is one of the respondents in the application challenging the legitimacy of President Mnangagwa. Zimbabwe's Constitutional Court is yet to set a hearing date for the case. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Troop contributing countries of the African Union mission in Somalia, also known as AMISOM, are calling on the African Union and international partners to support the mission. Sam Kutesa, Uganda's Minister of Foreign Affairs, warns the mission might lose the gains it has made unless it is strengthened.
In his speech to foreign affairs ministers and ministers of defense from AMISOM contributing members, Minister Kutesa started by outlining the achievements the mission has had in the last 11 years.
These are and include the Somali government, previously based out of the country, has been based in Mogadishu for a long time now. International organizations, including the United Nations, have also relocated to Mogadishu. More than 80% of Al-Shabaab dominated areas have been liberated. The threat of piracy at sea that threatened international shipping and trade has been neutralized. Business is thriving, and there are many reconstruction activities in many parts of the country, and we have witnessed regular elections that have been held.
The UN Security Council last year passed a resolution calling for a phased withdrawal of AMISOM troops from Somalia and eventual handover of management of security to the country's force. But Kutesa says the Somali army must be left in a position when it can effectively perform its duties.
As we all know, AMISOM was never intended to be in Somalia forever. That is why it is essential that the government of Somalia accelerates efforts and is supported to shoulder its responsibility in providing security for its people. It is crucial that the drawdown of AMISOM is synchronized with the corresponding strengthening of Somali security forces. The failure to carefully manage this process would imperil the political and security gains already made.
Kutesa says the mission still has inadequate troop numbers and lacks sustainable funding. Ismail Charugai, the Africa Union Commissioner for Peace and Security, agrees.
There is broad agreement on the need for a comprehensive approach to transition and the need to identify SNSF elements that will be responsible for implementing the transition plan. The core group meeting is expected to finalize a realistic, phased and condition-based draft transition plan before the end of March 2018. The primary focus of the African Union in the coming period should then be supported.
SNAF stands for the Somali National Armed Forces, the Somali National Army. At least 29 people were killed and dozens more wounded after the double car bomb blast in the Somali capital last week. AMISOM was established to work with the Somali Army to reduce the threat posed by Al-Shabaab and other armed opposition groups. The troop contributing countries, the AMISOM, are Burundi, Djibouti, Ethiopia, Kenya and Uganda, while the police contributing countries are Kenya, Ghana, Nigeria, Sierra Leone as well as Uganda. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Sierra Leoneans go to the polls next Wednesday to elect a successor to President Ernest Bai Koroma, who is stepping down after a decade in power. Many issues, including the economy and corruption, are dominating the campaign. Amnesty International West Africa researcher Sabrina Matani, who is in Freetown, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the human rights issues that are being discussed by the contenders.
There are some NGO regulations which were passed in secret in November, and this was only made public very recently, a few weeks ago. Lots of civil society groups have come out against these regulations. They're very restrictive. They give the government a lot of power to control what NGOs do, to review budgets, policies. And this, of course, makes it very difficult, especially for NGOs who might be working on things which are in opposition to the government. And two of the UN special rapporteurs, the one on freedom of expression and one on protection of human rights defenders, released a statement to the government urging them to revise them and saying that they actually didn't conform with international human rights obligations. There's no impact of the regulations right now because they're not being enforced, because it's an election time. But lots of groups are calling on whoever comes to power after the election to really consider revising these, because otherwise it's going to really clamp down on civil society, which is very vibrant in Sierra Leone.
I know today there is scheduled a women debate in Freetown among some of the female candidates. What are some of the women's rights issues in regards to human rights that are being discussed in this run-up to the election?
In particular, women are really disappointed. The gender equality bill was put before government in 2007, and over 10 years later, it's still not been passed. And this would have allowed 30% quotas for women in political spheres. And we see the impact of not having this even now. In this election, there's still very few women who are contending and contesting. There's only one presidential candidate who's a woman. And so I think in the debate tonight, this issue is still going to be very much, you know, at the front of saying, how are we going to get and encourage more women into politics? Because if we want to change things, we really need women to be in these leadership roles. And then secondly, I think there'll be a lot of debate around FGM. There's been a temporary ban on FGM during the election. And also things like safe abortion. Current government did not pass a safe abortion bill. And Sierra Leone has a very high rate of maternal mortality. And then lastly, the government also introduced a very controversial ban on pregnant girls from going to school and taking exams.
That was Sabrina Matani, West Africa researcher for Amnesty International. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Sierra Leone's capital, Freetown. French President Emmanuel Macron's groundbreaking promise to return colonial-era artifacts to Africa may face its first test next week when he holds talks in Paris with his Beninese counterpart, Patrice Talon. At issue are treasures from the former kingdom of Dahomey, which ended up in French museums and private collections. As Lisa Bryan reports for VOA from Paris, the practicalities of repatriation are both complicated and controversial.
The Quai Branly Museum in Paris holds thousands of African artifacts. Quelle masks from Gabon, Cameroon, and Republic of Congo, Baoulé and Dan sculptures from Côte d'Ivoire, and royal Dahomey artifacts from what is modern-day Benin. Like those elsewhere in Europe, France's top public museum for African art is now reconsidering its collection amid rising questions about whether some of it was looted or otherwise unfairly acquired from former colonies. Restitution claims are not new, but now President Emmanuel Macron is giving them new impetus. During a keynote speech in Ouagadougou last November, he said Africa's cultural heritage could no longer remain in European museums and private collections. Over the next 5 years, he said, artifacts in France must be temporarily or permanently returned to Africa. In 2016, Benin became the first African country to ask France for its artifacts back. Several thousand pieces taken from the former Kingdom of Dahomey by French soldiers and missionaries. A number ended up at Quai Branly. But the answer by the previous French administration was no. The art was now French property. Beninois like Marie-Cécile Zinsou reject that argument. She heads the Zinsou Foundation in Cotonou, which promotes African art.
Benin heritage is shown in France. It's shown in New York. It's shown in London. It's shown in Berlin. The only place where you can't see it is Benin, because the French, they left with everything.
There's also a powerful economic dimension. Art attracts tourists, like the millions coming to Paris each year. And tourists, notes Louis-Georges Tain, bring money. Tain heads CAN, an umbrella group of French Black associations and a key restitution campaigner.
If you want tourists to come to your country, you need to have a cultural legacy to show to the world. And how can you do that when most of your legacy has been robbed by many people in the Western countries?
Some critics argue African art is now universal patrimony and that many African countries don't have the facilities to house old and fragile artifacts. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin with the record transfer fee paid for Democratic Republic of Congo striker Cedric Bakambu, who now owns the title as the most expensive African footballer of all time after completing a $19 million move to Chinese Super League club Beijing Guoan from Villarreal. Bakambu upset Gabon striker Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang as Africa's most expensive player. Aubameyang moved to Arsenal from Borussia Dortmund for $77 million after penning a four-year contract in January.
I'm very happy to be here in my new team, and I hope we will make a very good season, and good luck for us.
Staying with football news, one of Africa's five representatives to the summer 2018 Russia World Cup, the Super Eagles of Nigeria, has downplayed the possibility of lifting the most prized trophy in world football. Coach of the Super Eagles of Nigeria, General Turao, says the dream of winning the World Cup is a good one, but football fans in Nigeria must be realistic.
When you want to dream and you have the right to dream, you can say that we can win. Everybody can win. But if you are realistic, we are number 52 in FIFA ranking. It would be a wonderful surprise if Nigeria could come already until the quarter or semi-final and to the final. But let's dream and let's hope to do the best.
And now to rugby news. Rassie Erasmus has been confirmed as the new head coach of South Africa's national rugby team, the Springboks, on an unusually long six-year contract, with the former Springboks loose forward given the chance to lead the team through the next two Rugby World Cups in 2019 and 2023. Rassie Erasmus, who played 36 tests for the Springboks from 1997 to 2001 and captained his country in one test, replaced Alistair Kozie, who left as head coach last month, halfway through his contract, following a dismal 2 years' performance.
I've been in the setup since the beginning, and I know what the targets are and what the challenges are and what the obstacles are. And you know, I really think we can make a hell of a contribution. And I wouldn't have taken the job if I thought there was something that's going to stop us from performing.
In table tennis news, Kenyan duo of Sejal Takar and Brian Mutua have been eliminated from the International Table Tennis Federation Africa Continental Cup, which got underway in Nairobi on Thursday. The Kenyans each lost their opening two preliminary round matches at the Kasarani Gymnasium. The three-day event has attracted 32 top players from Africa. The top two players in the male and female category in the tournament will represent Africa in next year's World Table Tennis Championships in Budapest, Hungary. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. And that is it for this Friday, March 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good weekend.
Music time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in feast your ears and dig into an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.